This episode of Walsh Wednesday is brought to you by NHA of Dutchess County, Foman Wash Car Wash, Juniors 2, the Kyle Robinson Memorial Foundation, the Council on Addiction Prevention and Education of Dutchess County Incorporated, Dayrock, Feldman Kleiman Collins and Sape LLP, Attorneys at Law, and Walsh Valuation.
Let's stay curious, keep an open mind, and as always, I'm glad we get to spend some time. Welcome to Walsh Wednesday.
I just want to make sure that I'm saying everything correctly. Chirac. Like,
yes, Chirac.
I was like, I'm making sure that it's like, it's not Sherrick, right?
Right.
It's like
right.
Chirac.
And a lot of people do that. Say Dwayne Sherrick.
Dwayne the Rock Chirac.
Yes, it's like the Rock. That's exactly. What I always say. It's
you're
like
so Dwayne, close to
the
it
Rock
there.
Johnson, Chirac Johnson. Yep.
Yeah. Have you ever thought about adding the Johnson to your name? Kidding. Kidding. Sure, you go up to places like Dwayne Chirac, and they're like Dwayne the Rock, and it's like,
no, I'm not that guy.
There was a
no relation.
I think it was an ESPN commercial where it was this guy whose name was Michael Jordan. He was a white dude about like 5'4". And he would go to reservations or appointments. It's like, name, Michael Jordan. And they would all look up, like, excited at first. And then they're like, oh.
That's got to be great.
Hey there, and welcome back to Walsh Wednesday. As always, I'm Connor Walsh, coming to you from the MHA studios here in Poughkeepsie, and we got a great episode for you guys today. With us, we have an author. He's going to be doing a book signing at the Willow Bookshop and Lounge on Wednesday, July 15th. With us, we have the author of Igniting the Engine of Intent, Understanding the Cognitive Mind and the Metacognitive Matrix. We're going to be talking about purpose, clarity, momentum, and so much more out of this. With us, we have author Dwayne Chirac. Dwayne, how are you?
All right, great. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So happy to have you in here. The very first time that we met was originally through the Vital Women podcast, which I was producing there for about a year. Then, of course, I've worked with your wife on a number of occasions. She, who I also met through the Vital Women, but then we've done a couple of events and or just run into each other. I think the last time I saw her was at a festival at the Falls. Last time I saw her. So we kind of have this circle and web of connection going on here.
That's great. Yeah, she's all over the place. She's the reason why I'm here.
Yeah. Absolutely. No, she was the one that texted. It was like, Connor, can we make this happen? It's like, I got you. So, of course, big shout out to her. Of course, thank you very much.
Thank you, Rocio.
One of these days, we'll have to get her into the studio as well. We only had her in the blue one, in the 3D Neptune.
Yes.
But, of course, this is big. You got a book signing happening at Willow Bookshop and Lounge on Wednesday the 15th. Wednesday, you picked a good day.
Yeah.
Very good. But with that, of course, Igniting the Engine of Intent, we have the book right here. Looks fantastic. I have yet to read it. So, for anybody out there who is brand new to this, they're curious, what can they expect out of this book here?
Well, it's a book that reframes thinking.
Okay.
It teaches metacognition and reflection. You know, a lot of times, you know, like in the old days, back when I was a kid, we weren't taught how to write. We were generally assigned writing. We were generally taught like grammar rules, what a sentence is, what a paragraph is. They'll say like topic sentence, but the craft of it, the artistry of it, we weren't really taught. We're just basically, this is your assignment, this is the theme, and I'll mark it up. But in this book, it's, you know, everybody now, you know, is starting to grow this whole idea of metacognition and how powerful it is to actually help people perform better, to accomplish things. You know, being more, metacognition is thinking about thinking. But it's, you know, in school where they've, you know, they mainly focus on the cognitive mind, like the logical, rational mind.
Mm-hmm.
And now only recently, I would say like in the last 10, 15 years, they started getting into the emotional intelligence, but they're just dabbling into that.
Yeah.
And, but now, you know, they're starting to talk about, you know, teachers becoming more reflective, being more aware of what they're doing, being more intentional for teaching and facilitating learning. And we want kids to think more about what their thinking is. But what they'll find out in the book is that thinking is not just all in your head. It's your body, it's your emotions, and it's your cognitive domain. Okay.
And it's, I'm glad that you said that last part there, because it says here in the subtitle, the cognitive mind and the metacognitive matrix. And I had to do some research ahead of this because I had to make sure that I was getting all the definitions right myself. I'm familiar with metacognitive and cognitive, but conative was brand new to me. So for anybody else who might be thinking that conative is a typo, would you like to explain that?
Yes, that was the bane of my spell check.
Spell check didn't like it either, huh?
Spell check, you know, I take a lot of notes, voice notes, and then I'd have the AI transcribe my voice notes.
Speech to text was not a fan.
And it was not a fan. It kept trying to say cognitive. And conative is something, there's a lady named Colby, C-O-H-L-B-E, I believe the spelling is. She actually has a standardized test for looking at what she called your modus operandi. And basically, in your conative mind, she said, and it was very narrow, but it basically describes how you like to engage with information. Mm-hmm. Like some people like to engage with the research of information. Some people like to immediately just go into projects, like make projects. So she, excuse me,
you're good.
She kind of introduced, not her personally, but introduced me to the term. Mm. You know, it was like, I was on LinkedIn where I found this. Mm. And LinkedIn, you know, back 10 years ago, I was just getting into like trying to have a web presence, and I knew I wanted to do something about the mind. And one of the respondents, one of the commentators, introduced me to in an area where we talk about creativity. Mm. And she introduced me to the conative domain and Colby. And that led me down this rabbit hole of like sparse bits of research here and there. Mm. But I did find out that William James, one of the forefathers of psychology, was all about conative domain. Like he kept talking about it, and it's, you know, talking about volition, the part of our mind that says you want to do something and you want to accomplish something. And this is very different from the emotions. Emotions are mainly reactive. You know, they're like how you respond to things. They kind of guide you in what your values are. Like you are going to feel bad things about stuff that, you know, is against your values or against your aesthetics. And so it's not emotion, but emotion can be used like a kind of like fuel to get you excited about accomplishing something.
Gotcha.
Okay, so it can kind of drive motivation. It can kind of be the gas, but volition is like you at the steering wheel, pushing on the gas, choosing the direction. And so William James was really into that. And then by me looking at that, I thought about the rhetorical appeals. Mm. And the rhetorical appeals goes back to Plato.
Mm, okay.
Ancient Greece.
Yeah.
Ancient philosopher. And it turns out he is the one that developed this tripartite mind model, which he sometimes called the soul. And he says, you know, same thing. You have the emotion, you have the intellect, but he called it, you know, the pathos for emotion. Yeah. And you had logos for the cognitive part of the mind. And then you had ethos and kairos. And ethos is about credibility, developing the idea, like when, because you're all, you know, like you're presenting to a group, you're presenting to an audience. Mm-hmm. So ethos is, you know, not just it's really saying, why should we listen to you? Mm. You know, what is it about you that would make us want to know, you know, about what you're trying to say? And usually, oration is about a call to action. It's about trying to get people to do something, to get behind an idea. Mm-hmm. So I was like, all right, well, you know, the appeals, you know, makes a sense, you know, but, they're appealing to some part of your brain, you know, it's, you know, the pathos appealing to emotions is appealing to that emotional side of you, that emotional part of you. And it's the same thing with the logos. It's the intellect. How is this making sense? Where's the logic? Where are the steps? You know, what are you basing this on? You know, what's the evidence? You know, developing, you know, knowledge about that. And then it was the ethos. And while, you know, you learn more and more about rhetoric, it was like the paltry side. Hmm. You know, it was not much talked about. And, you know, from those earlier days, it's just like you introduce yourself as who you are, what your bona fides are, or bona fides, I'm not really sure how to pronounce that. And You have, you know, what is your standing in the community? Like later on, people, like when you see a speech, mm-hmm. they, you know, the speaker will identify themselves. They'll identify what, you know, who they worked with, what their degrees are. Mm. And, you know, basically they're saying, you know, I'm an expert. You should listen to me, you know, and then getting that out of the way, people are more open to receiving the message that you're, you know, you're trying to deliver, facilitate.
Do you agree with that sentiment where you feel like you have to pretty much give like a whole list of credits before you go out and say your piece? Or is there a method where you feel like you can just kind of go into whatever you're trying to orate? You're talking about that level of oration.
Well, I love that question. Do I believe in it? I do, but I believe it's just a facet. Mm. Okay. People can have their titles, they can have their degrees, but if they walk in front of people and they don't carry themselves correctly, if they don't use the right words, the right vocabulary, have the right accent sometimes, you know, getting in front of people and using the big words that you would use in front of your peers will turn a lot of people off, you know? So on the one hand, it can be useful, but it's got to connect with, again, how you present yourself. It's a different thing. It's like, what's your role? That's another thing where I found out with Conation. We're talking, you know, I've learned about role enactment. And by you just labeling yourself and claiming to have status, it's not status. You have to establish it. Yeah. You know, you have to live that role and people have to see you. You know, if you're a doctor wearing that nice white lab coat, it identifies you as a doctor. People will listen to the person that walks in with the lab coat before they even know their name. They might not even introduce themselves, but you know the place, there's the setting, that's the schema. You walk in and somebody with a lab coat comes in, that's your doctor. Okay, and this is the person you're supposed to listen to. So I do believe it can reduce the friction. It can reduce the resistance of receiving a message.
Yeah.
But it helps. So you can say, who is this person? Who is this lady coming up in front of me talking like she knows something? Why should I listen to her? And, you know, how can I challenge what she's saying? Or if I have the standing to challenge what she's saying.
Yeah.
And so I find that, you know, looking at speech writing and looking at how people get up in front of a camera or up on stage or in front of the microphone or a podium. It's also annoying. I mean, like you see different politicians.
Yeah.
They sometimes will affect a certain accent, you know, especially if they come from that area where they, you know, if they're from the South and they're trying to drum up interest in their candidacy, that drawl that they don't use in Washington or won't use in northern cities, they suddenly comes out, you know, and code switching is another piece of evidence.
Yeah,
you know, where you know, if you're talking, you know, me as a black man, if I start slipping into slang, and I'm, you know, I don't normally talk slang, but I used to talk a lot more, you know, slang and had more of a dialect, but after going to college and everything, you learn that you do not show emotion as much as possible. You try to come off as pure mind, pure intellect. You're somehow, especially back in the day, any time emotion enters into a scholarly or academic discussion, they start to doubt your credibility because you're not playing the game. And it's the same thing with expectations. When you are making a point like this book, or, you know, trying to get people behind your ideas, most of the time, especially with academics, you're defending your points. It's a war, you know, it's a battle. And the way you choose words is like you're sure of where you're at. And it's kind of like a balancing act. Like, you're supposed to be able to be open to discussion and open to changing your mind, but you also have to have that posture of someone that's confident in what you're talking about.
No, very fair. It's kind of like you're always defending yourself against the 10th doctor. You know, it was like 9 out of 10 doctors say, yes, this is great.
Yes.
where's that 10th doctor who's disagreeing with it? You feel like sometimes you're always talking to that 10th doctor trying to convince them, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
That's very interesting about the, you know, bringing in the level of confidence, the level of logic versus the emotion, especially in an academic field. You know, me being in a more artistic field, when I have a number of speaking engagements, and many of them being which at schools, especially if I'm doing a career day, doing a panel, doing something like that, right. If I'm allowed to, I always open up with a story first,
right?
Before I open up with anything that has to do with my credentials, because so many times I've sat there in those seats and I'm like, sure, great, those are your credentials, but no offense to anybody, but it's like, why should I care? I remember being that teenager of kind of just zoning out during just listing off the resume, but I found the people that I cared about most were the ones that grabbed me right away with something interesting. So that's what I do. But again, I'm still presenting from a lot more artistic, and we can absolutely say emotional side of things.
Right.
Where do you think in an academic realm then, do you think it is okay to start letting some of that emotion bleed in? Or do you believe that there's a place for it?
I believe there is a place for it, and I believe it's necessary. You know, I'm kind of upset with myself because I was supposed to start with a story, you know, the story about why I wrote the book, and the book has a bunch of scenarios, you know, where it's trying to dramatize, you know, certain concepts and certain struggles with those concepts, to ground it, to help people connect to these ideas that they're not just pie in the sky abstractions. They're things you can use.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, let's get into your story then. Why? Tell us the why.
Well, it's funny. I'm a big reader, and you know, it's sort of like one of those deals where there's a lot of origin stories because the problem is to keep writing this kind of thing, you develop different reasons.
Yeah.
That get you to keep writing. You know, different entryways. You know, ways to enter into this project. And one of the stories is my youngest son. You know, he has some really serious ADHD, and he's comorbid for some other things. Has other diagnosis connected with that's what comorbid it had connected to that. And when he was little, he would call these things like the jiggers, and he had no word for it, but it's like he would be like flopping around like it seemed like something was under his skin and in his muscles that was making him really uncomfortable. And it, like the only way for him to get rid of the jiggers was to drink juice. So, you know, so before going to bed each night, you know, we would try to wean him off, you know, to protect his teeth and, you know, whole sugar thing. But, you know, if after a certain point of time, he would be like writhing on the bed saying the jiggers are here, the jiggers. And I was like, wow, what is this? You know, why, you know, he was too young to explain how it felt. So I had to like look at him and try to empathize, you know, but yeah, so that was one of the things. And, you know, I have the certification in special education and I was in education. And later on, I was working in elementary school, special ed elementary school, and this one student, he never could sit down. He always needed to be standing, but he also had some other triggers. And one thing is like once he became dysregulated, once he became like energized and just completely uncomfortable, and you know just all kinds of things would come out of his mouth where it was just like, yo, like if he was in a regular school, he would have ended up getting suspended, possibly expelled.
Oh, geez.
But so, you know, but we had more flexibility to handle that. You know, it was a school for kids with special needs. So some of that stuff we knew not to be threatened or offended by these things because they were basically symptoms of what was, you know, going on with them. So this my principal told me, give him a sensory blanket, give him a weighted blanket. Said here, she handed it to me, and I had just come from the high school, so very little of my experience was working with kids with sensory processing disorders. Very little sensory issues. You know, I was mainly you know dealing with students with anxiety, and some mental illness, and some intellectual disabilities, and So I came and they had conduct disorders. They had, you know, they were struggling with oppositional defiance disorder. Mm-hmm. So when she said, put the blanket on him, I said, oh, sure. You know, you want me to hug him too? Mm-hmm. You know, thinking like, this is ridiculous. Mm. And I put that blanket on him and you felt it.
Really?
You felt, I felt his almost immediate calm.
Wow.
Like all of that distress just went out of him with this weighted like blanket wrapped around him.
Kind of like a cloak kind of sense, or you put it on his lap? No, how'd you have it on?
You know, he was standing.
Okay.
And I was standing. And I took the blanket and said, here, I'm going to put this on you. You know?
Yeah.
And I put it on him. And I went through a complete transformation. In that moment of just visibly and within my own body feeling his sudden calm, I was convinced that sensory is a major challenge.
Yeah.
And that just connected me to my own son's struggles. And, you know, I have two sons, and the older one, you know, couldn't hear a fork dragging across a plate. There were certain things, you know, he just couldn't do.
Mm-hmm.
And my youngest son, I have lots of stories about his sensory stuff, but, you know, we have a better, you know, response now, outcomes, better outcomes for both of them now.
Hmm.
But it was, you know, those were struggles having two kids with special needs in the house.
That's very curious. If you don't mind me asking this question then, you know, having your children at home and then having the children that you're working with for part of your job, would you say being a parent made you a better educator, being an educator made you a better parent, vice versa? Do you feel like one made one side better than the other, or do you feel like it was two pieces of a whole?
Well, you know, a lot of with this book, I talk about minding.
Mm.
You know, like it's not the mind, which is like a container of your capabilities and knowledge and, you know, feelings and intellect. It's a process. So minding is, you know, it's dynamic. It's the different parts interacting with each other, feeding into each other or blocking each other or energizing or depressing.
Mm.
Each other. And that's how I would answer your question. I mean, there were some times when I was so exhausted from my day at work that by the time I came home, I didn't want to talk to anybody. I didn't want to make any decisions because I was making decisions all day.
You're exhausted.
Yeah. So I was tired. And, so when you ask that question, it's like, well, sometimes I feel like it took away from my parenting.
Interesting.
You know, but on the other hand, it also informed my parenting because a lot of the training that I had in schools and a lot of my experiences made me aware of sensory issues, of mental health, of self-care, like all the things that we trained teachers and students and other staff how to deal with, or we were given these professional development. I was one of those people that processed it. You know, I engaged with it. And when I came home, you know, I mean, sometimes I didn't have the patience, but most of the time I understood what was happening, why I was getting some of these responses and what I needed to do to help, you know, my kids deal with these distractions and these sensory inputs.
Yeah.
And pause. We're going to take a quick break from our interviews to hear from our sponsors.
Mental Health America of Dutchess County and Reviver Entertainment Group present The Sound of Nashville in the Hudson Valley's Queen City. Featuring headliner, Grand Ole Opry member, and CMT Award nominee, Craig Morgan. With supporting acts, two-time Grammy nominee, Maggie Rose. Finalist of season 19 of The Voice and Hudson Valley native, Ian Flanagan. Viral sensation, Jake Banfield, and special guest, Broadway to country star, Brooke Morber. The Sound of Nashville, one night only. Tuesday, October 6th at the Bardavon Opera House in Poughkeepsie, New York. Visit bardavon.org for ticket information.
For 60 years, we here at Foam and Wash Car Wash pride ourselves on giving back to the community because we're your neighbors. It's our community too. In celebration of Foam and Wash's 60th anniversary, we want to say thank you. By visiting the link on screen and in the description, you'll receive one free hot wax and shine car wash. No hassles, no gimmicks, just a token of our appreciation.
Foam and Wash Car Wash, home of the Unlimited Wash membership.
Thank you for being part of Foam and Wash Car Wash's story for the last 60 years.
Thanks for listening, guys. It's time to get back to the show and play.
Well, it's fascinating you say all that, because obviously with your book, you're trying to give the readers a bigger sense of clarity. And it was through your job that you were able to get a greater sense of clarity as a parent, as an educator, and all of the above there. So when people are reading this book and they're looking for a sense of clarity, what is it specifically in here that you've intertwined and ingrained into this that can give others a sense of clarity?
Well, I made a tool.
Okay.
I call it the Metacognition Reflection and Reporting Tool. And this was because one of my, you know, a couple of my friends said, you know, you gotta, you know, when back in the early days when I first started talking about, oh, I'm gonna write this book, they're like, yeah, but what is it going to do? And how is it gonna help people? Because at that time it was just my curiosity and mm-hmm. interest driving the research.
It was still abstract in a sense.
It was still abstract. And then he said, you have to make it, and now right now I forgot the word, but it has to be something that they can use, people can use.
Has to be tangible in a sense.
It has to be tangible, and the word will come to me when I leave.
But it'll be 3 o'clock in the morning. You'll text me and be like, Connor, I remember it.
It's this, edit it in. Yep. So I don't look like a fool. But yeah, so the, yes. You know, so my friend who worked in, you know, as a medical journalist, he also said tools, that's the key to everything. You know, you can't just have a book. People want to have a tool. So I was like, well, I actually had a tool. Okay. What was happening was I was developing a grid, the matrix, mm-hmm. of how many different combinations of the different parts of your mind can interact to create different experiences. So, you know, so I said, okay, I have four parts. And so how do these four parts interact? And it a big part of the job was, okay, how do I categorize emotions? Because there's a lot of gray areas.
Oh, big time.
Between emotion and thoughts and emotions and sensory experiences. So so I had to decide there was going to be gray areas, and I'm not going to worry about being exact. But they had to fit within these different categories. So then I said, you know, how do I do this? This is like mathematical now.
I was going to say it's near infinite at that point.
Well, it that was part of the idea. Yeah. And so it turns out with those four things, 256.
Okay.
Okay, 256 combinations. And what I had to do, I got on the computer. This was early days before AI, but they had a web page that could actually calculate your combinatorials, the combinations. So all you had to do is say how many parts there were and how they would interact. And then it took I used a letter for each part.
Okay.
And then I had to process it. And it turned out to be 256.
256. Okay. Yes. So, all right. Not infinite, but it can sound a little overwhelming to some people.
And that's not even thinking about, to talk about overwhelm. It's like, you know, you have different levels of intensity. Mm. So you could feel certain things, think certain things that are not always very intense. And other times, it's very intense, especially with ideesthesia. Mm. Okay. Now, ideesthesia is something I experience, and it's this experience of thoughts, ideas actually having temperature,
yeah,
weight,
yeah,
textures, size, and sometimes you, as you know, especially if I'm introduced to a new idea, sometimes they collide and they meld into each other, mm. and you know, temperatures change. You know, in my head, you know, sometimes I can, the back of my throat, I can feel, you know, these shifts.
Yeah.
And for that is really intense. And there's a way to kind of show that within the matrix. Mm. But that was the other reason. I said I wanted to help people understand how to access this way of thinking. Mm. And you know, in special ed, in education, we have these things called graphic organizers. Mm-hmm. There's a company called Thinking Maps. Then they have like tools that help you visualize your thinking. Said, that's what I need. I need to take this mathematical grid, this matrix, and turn it into a tool. Mm-hmm. So, and that's, and that's what you have in the book is I have a light version, which it starts to introduce the process to you. Mm-hmm. And then I have the MRRT 2.0,
okay,
which is like, you know, when you become used to thinking like this, you use that to actually journal.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So when you're like, you have people who write their diaries and they write their journals, and sometimes the journal is purely rational, intellectual thought. And sometimes it's how they felt for it, you know, like with some diaries is their diary, you know, I had a great day. I felt like this, I felt like that, but we're more than that.
Yeah.
And we're always going towards something or trying to avoid something or going away from something. And that's where the volition, the cognitive domain comes in. Mm. And to have that visual piece helps people keep track and helps them look for those sensations or those experiences that they might ignore or not have a word for, you know, and that's another key is having words for your experiences that our culture generally, because of behaviorism and that, you know, that like this wave of I have to be able to measure and observe this, mm-hmm. you know, it wiped out conation research for a while. It completely suppressed it and repressed it, like actively. Mm-hmm. And so I'm trying to give that visual, that graphic organizer that helps you. And a lot of the thinking in there is based on Cabrera's DSRP, which is a kind of systems thinking tool. And one of the things that he said, like one of the P is perspective taking.
Okay.
And one of the things he said was, the more you perspective take, the more you explore other people's experiences from their perspectives, the better you get at it.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's not just something that people can or can't do. It's something you can, these are skills that you can build.
Yeah. This is something you can practice and develop over time.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's huge. Yeah. With the matrix and being able to visualize things, I'm very much a visual learner. Uh-huh. As much as I am a hands-on person, uh-huh. somebody just instructing me through something is not always enough. I have to physically see it, get my hands on it to try to like actually, you know, make it feasible and tangible in my own sense.
Right.
So I'm very curious about this matrix, this two-part question here. How has this matrix benefited you? And then what are some examples of the ways that you have worked with others, whether it's a client, student, or just simply another reader? What kind of reactions have you gotten to said matrix?
Well, to answer the first part, the matrix was something to express what I do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like how I move through the day or how I interact with people or ideas or, you know, like reading in books and stuff like that. So for me, it was a way to send a flare out to people to say, this is how I think, this is how, you know, this will help others if you could learn how to think like this. And it can map how you feel, but you could also use it as a kind of compass.
Mm.
That will help you to help guide you. Because my original conception of it was to be able to say, you know, like I'm a creative as well, and you know I like to write and dance and sing, and one of the things as a writer, as I was learning different types of tools, different strategies, different approaches, is how a writer might say, I'm going to write as if I'm a chair. So I'm going to write from this perspective. What does this chair feel?
Yeah.
You know, what would it experience? So it's like games like that. Like actors probably do that too.
Yeah.
You know, they're
improv scenarios.
Improv scenarios, activities, exercises, games. They do all this stuff to expand their ability to experience the world and to express themselves. And that idea fascinated me. And I said, you know, in education, we had this wave where, you know, a trend or fad, I don't know if it what to call it, but it was this idea that kids have different ways to express what they know. Mm-hmm. And they should be able to express this in different ways. Like everybody's not going to be able to, you know, to just sit down and write a paper, you know, write an essay. And most people aren't doing that in the world of work. You're not writing essays, you know, you're making presentations.
Yep.
Okay. And they said, you know, and then Howard Gardner had the Multiple Intelligences book, Habits of the Mind, I think it was called. And that was about the different intelligences, like there are kinesthetic intelligence. And one of the exemplars, one of the the examples used was Michael Jackson. Michael Jackson is a genius of body movement.
Yes, without a doubt.
Without a doubt. I mean, he could also sing, but he could, and there's a whole wave of people that can express emotions and experiences through dance. Mm-hmm. And you knew what they were expressing.
Yeah.
You know, and they could show you sadness, they could show you rage and all these different things through dance. And I was like, there's got to be a way to map that. You know, how do you, start with emotion as an object and build choreography around that object or around that idea or that concept?
Materialize it
and to be able to do the opposite, interpret it.
Yeah.
You know, and, just like microphones and speakers. Microphones and speakers are the same thing. Okay, you could turn a speaker into a microphone, or you could use a microphone and turn it into a speaker. And I was like, wow, this is what I want. This is what I want to be able to do. I want to be able to be more creative and be able to look at something that, you know, someone's writing about or feeling. And how do you express that in poetry? How do you express that in words? Or how do you shape those, how the words on the page captures, you know, that particular perspective of feeling and thought? And, you know, chefs, you know, they're cooking. I was thinking about them and how there's so many different ways of cooking. There's so many different cuisines. And then you had the fusions. Mm-hmm. And then you had these chefs that were like talking at a whole other level about this is the whole theme of this meal and what these foods represent as part of that theme. And I'm like, I want that in my matrix. I want to be able to show that in the matrix. So that's where it was originally supposed to be. So the whole idea was, you know, you have 256 cells interactions, but that's, you know, that's not the first level. The first level is that one domain interacting with another domain, or one domain reacting to itself. And it, you know, like your emotion, happiness is reacting to sadness, or your rage is coming from sadness, and building from those two interactions up to three, then four interactions. But then you have another level where you can kind of like crystallize, take those blocks or those pyramids, and they connect so that when you are building the next level and the next level of thinking, it becomes harder and harder to keep that train of thought because you're trying to keep all of these parts active and engaged.
Yeah.
So then what do? That's why we have notebooks. We write our notes down. We have recordings. We have cameras, video cameras. We have the abacus. We have so many different tools developed so that we can keep our higher level thinking and maintain that higher level thinking. You know, so we do that. I mean, like Annie Murphy Paul wrote about the extended mind.
Okay.
And this extended mind came from like Chalmers and I forgot the other writer before her. And it's this whole idea that the objects that we have with us extend to us, extend to our minds. So one of the things I was amazed with, and stop me if I'm talking too long, if you're running out of time,
because fine right now.
I have a problem with that. But this whole idea, like, you know, Iron Man wearing armor, you know, you have football players wearing their shoulder pads. One of the things that amazed me is when I'm driving my car, I can feel when I'm too close to something.
Yeah.
If you feel it.
Yeah.
You know, like, okay, am I getting too close to the curb? It feels like I'm getting too close to the curb. Boom. Yep. You're right. You're too close to the curb. Or when you're trying to weave in, like somebody's waiting to make a turn and there's a little opening that you're really sure your car can fit.
Yeah.
And when you thread around that car, you could practically feel the other car's skin close to your car's skin.
Yeah.
And it's a crazy sensation because there are no nerves
no
in your car.
But it is interesting because it does become an extension of yourself.
It becomes extension of yourself.
So as what you said about like the recording capabilities of the ways that we're able to put stuff down, whether it's through microphone, whether it's through speech to text, whether it's through a camera, something like that, we're not limited anymore simply to pen and paper. There's a number of ways of having that expression and that extension. So with a near infinite way of being able to find ways to express, do you believe that makes communication easier or harder today?
My
okay.
I don't ask the easy questions here, Dwayne.
I think communication has become very difficult, okay? Because it's become much more difficult because there are now more ways to communicate.
Yeah.
There was another contributor to my thinking was about communication. There's a book called The Information. It came out. James Gleick or Gleick.
Okay.
I don't hear these names.
You just read. So I understand.
I don't know the pronunciation, yep. So I apologize. But this whole idea that there are these levels and of engagement. So, you know, now we have email, okay? Now we have text.
Yeah.
Now we have the ability to FaceTime or communicate by video, you know? And what this chart did was placed those different technologies on a chart. And it was from the least amount of engagement to the most engagement. Because, you know, if somebody sends you a text, you might be able to respond. But what if they send you a memo?
Oh, like a voice memo?
No.
Oh.
Like paper memo.
Oh, paper memo. Okay.
You know, like back in, you know, sometimes they hand out memos.
That just shows my age and where I am technology. Does, but yeah.
You know, so it's like back when I was young. Yeah, so you have these memos. Mm-hmm. And basically, you read the memo and you have to interpret it. Now, if you have any questions, that means you're going to have to find the person that wrote the memo, yep. Call them, text them, email them, whatever. But you don't have that immediate ability to question and confirm what your understanding is.
Yeah.
Okay. And then that's with texting. It's a little higher on that chart because now, you know, you guys can go back and forth. Text, 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 text. You know, you might be in a low broadcast area, you know, low band area where voice is impossible, but your texts do get in and out. Yeah. And you can text back and forth. Okay, but you don't see their face, you don't hear the tone of their voice, and that can create problems because sometimes those misinterpretations can be catastrophic.
Easily.
Especially if you're being sarcastic.
High school drama is based on it.
Well, adult drama's been plenty of it,
too. Adult drama, too. You ever see the Key and Peele sketch of them texting back and forth?
No.
There's a sketch where one of the guys is like, hey, we still meeting up later, and he's all lighthearted about it. And it's like, yeah, no, dude, whatever. And it's like, whatever?
Yeah. What?
What? Are you ready to go? And it's like, oh, right now? Okay, sure, why not?
Yeah, they're going back and forth thinking one is like angry, getting more infuriated. Yep. And the other one's like,
is like,
I'm still in my perspective. I mean, I know and, what I meant.
And then when they go to the bar together, he's like, hey, how are you? Punch right in the face.
Yep. That's a great dramatization of the problem with texting.
Yep.
And it's, you know, it just works up the line where you have all these different technologies, whether it's email, the voicemails, the, but even when you have the two-way TV screen of like FaceTiming or meetings, meetups, telemet, whatever you're going to call it.
Yeah, the Zooms, the Teams of the world. Yeah.
Right. Skype. Which we, you know, suddenly got exposed to with COVID.
With COVID. Yeah.
And, but we also learned other things, the screen fatigue.
Yeah.
Where it's not the same thing as being in person. You can't last as long in front of a screen talking to people as you could if you were face to face.
Oh yeah.
Which was totally unexpected. You know, it was almost counterintuitive because you're like saying, why would you have so much trouble? But there's a lot, that's when you start getting into the loads.
Yeah.
And the amount of energy you expend trying to interpret facial expressions and tone and posture and hesitations in your voice or emphasis in a voice, you know, the paralinguistics of talking.
Yep.
And you're like, I'm tired. I'm exhausted. And I'm just looking at somebody's face. You don't see their whole body. You know, you're not, there's something in proximity that you can pick up because there's like this interaction between bodies.
Yeah.
You know,
but you still, there's a disconnect. Still.
There is a disconnect.
There's still a disconnect. You are only getting part of the picture. And then the fact that you and I are talking here face to face, it's not only just the fact that I can see all of you, I can hear every emotion of what you're saying, but there is something about the energy that we bring to it as well. Like we're in our energy fields, essentially, is like there's a lot of talk that can go into that. That's a whole other discussion in and of itself. But just simply reading and feeding off somebody else's energy, it's just like when, like, you know, I'm a performer, read off the crowd, like take the energy of the crowd, and that's what you're able to give back, and vice versa.
Yeah.
You know, and same with a one-on-one conversation. Sure, sometimes you can get that level of excitement and enthusiasm over Zoom if you click just right, but there's still always something about that sit-down one-on-one experience.
Yeah, there's something interfering with the communication. And that was something that chart told me.
Yeah.
That it's not just the voice. It's not just the words of the message. Your message is emotional.
Yeah.
It's also about roles. You know, for the cognitive domain, your role and how you, is expressed by how you carry yourself. And if there's a disconnect from how you carry yourself and what you say your role is, you start to question it. You know, a lot of times, you know an engineer when you meet an engineer. You know, you know, because there's some habit of mind, there's some aspect to how they organize their thoughts, how they communicate, you know, and teachers, you know, it's like in the
I know so many teachers, so it's like, you're a teacher, aren't
you're
you?
You're a teacher, I can tell. Or are you a cop? Are you a cop? You know, so there's these different things that your role communicates through your body and how you speak and everything. So it's kind of funny how you can zone in on these different things that are at a whole nother level of awareness.
Yeah.
And it's not talking about psychic energy. I'm talking about, you know, it's like you know, when they talk about mirror neurons, and when you're watching a person do something that you know how to do and you're watching them, your brain responds as if you're doing it and you're not moving.
Yeah.
But you're processing it as if you're doing it.
Yeah.
That's wild. And I think that's what's coming down to.
And then you have like the positive experiences when somebody's doing it fast and easy and seamless. And then when you see the people who are kind of struggling with it, and you're kind of like,
yes, you want to like, okay, let me help you. Nope. Don't help me.
Let me do it.
Let me help you. I can help you. I can do it. Just let me do it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just let me do it because you're making me crazy.
Yeah, but you're right. It is that sense of, you know, when we watch somebody do it, we internalize it and personify it within ourselves to the degree of like we see somebody else struggling with it. It makes it feel like we're struggling with it. And it almost feels like we're doing it with like an arm tied behind our back or something.
And that was one of the things that I started asking myself about the different parts having their different hungers. Okay.
Hungers. Okay.
Yeah.
Please dive into that.
All right. So, you know, in the cognitive mind, you're trying to satisfy the hunger of symmetry. You're trying to satisfy the hunger of solving the problem.
Reason, essentially, right?
Yes. Yeah. So you will feel a discomfort when something does not make sense.
Yeah.
Okay. And for some people, it's agonizing. Agonizing in the sense that they can't get their minds off of it. And that, you know, that's stuff we experience every day. You know, you made a mistake when you're talking to somebody, you said something the wrong way, and you realize they took it the wrong way and why they took it the wrong way.
Yeah.
And you ruminate on it and you want to fix it. Okay. So it's like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so you want to solve a problem. That's the hunger of the cognitive mind. There, and then there's, or you need more information, more knowledge to feed that cognitive mind.
Yeah.
It's like you can, you know, you can feel knowledge need. You want to read a new book. You want to learn a new skill. You want to practice something to improve on that skill, develop yourself. So there is that facet to the cognitive mind where there is hunger. And the same thing with emotions. You know, your emotions, you want to feel certain things. You know, values are feelings, and you want people to share your values. There is a dissonance when you are around people that don't share your values and they express that. You know, there's a sense that, you know, it's you can feel more calm around people that share many of your values.
Because otherwise you feel challenged.
It's challenge is how can I communicate with this person, because that whole ethos credibility thing, it's like, I'm not one of you. And me trying to explain where my world is compared to, you know, from my world to your world, it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
And that's what we experience with people from other cultures. That's what we experience with people who have a second language. You know, it's like you're saying, do I really want to expend this energy?
Yeah.
And a lot of times after you expend that energy, you get a lot of new information. You get you see a new perspective and you can be energized. I mean, how many times do you try new restaurants? Those are different foods and they express different values, different aesthetics through their food.
And pause. We're going to take a quick break from our interviews to hear from our sponsors.
This episode is also sponsored by Juniors 2. Come on out to Juniors 2 in Poughkeepsie, New York for Thursday Night Trivia, hosted by CMJW Entertainment. Play as a team as you work your way through four rounds of trivia categories in order to win gift certificates and other prizes. Juniors 2 Trivia Nights, every Thursday starting at 7 p.m. at 1126 Dutchess Turnpike, Poughkeepsie.
Next, we have a message from our friend Jeff Feldman from Feldman, Kleiman, Collins, and Sape LLP, attorneys at law.
Hi, I'm Jeff Feldman. In 1986, when Paul Kleiman and I started our practice, our goal was to create a law firm where you could meet with an attorney and feel confident that that attorney would be with you every step of the way. Today, the firm has been successfully trying cases at all levels of state and federal courts throughout the Hudson Valley and Capital District. We have been selected as one of the best personal injury and medical malpractice defense law firms by U.S. News and World Report every year since 2009. For all of those years, we were the only firm chosen in any litigation specialty between Albany and White Plains. Your case is important to us. Giving you the time and personal attention you deserve has always been the hallmark of success. Initial consultations are free of charge, and always with an attorney.
Thanks for listening, guys. It's time to get back to the show and play.
It's fascinating that you brought up the culture there, because we're in a very interesting time period right now in America with the World Cup going on. So many people from other countries are coming over and they're realizing what America is, and they're loving it. They're appreciating it. And they're like, oh my God, this isn't what I expected out of America. And that just goes to show the reputation we've gotten. But I think it's interesting that right now that a lot of the people who are coming in, who they're getting to appreciate it. And it's like, wow, this is amazing. And there's a lot of unity there, but a lot of the main discourse really is still internal, American versus American, than it is the people who are coming in and experiencing America for the first time and understanding what it is. So when it comes to like this internal divide, you know, what are the things, like, I'm not going to say specifically America, I'm not talking politics, but I'm saying a divide within a group where you feel like you should be working together, you should be cohesive, and there is that divide. How do we try to bridge that sense of communication or lack thereof?
Well, a lot of different things come to mind.
Yeah.
One is, like, you see a bunch of these cartoons, you have these memes, you have these movies where people who were very close-minded and had their very strong opinions about what other people were like, and then they go to these other countries. And by the time they come back after traveling, they're completely transformed. And they realize, hey, you know, Africa is a continent. It's not every country. It's not describing every country.
Yeah.
There. You know, oh, wow. You know, Spain has like more, there's people speak more than just Spanish there, mm-hmm. you know, and the Basques, and what the heck, who are these people? You know, and they, you know, so you start to find out that your simple world becomes more complicated and more complex. And that kind of opens you up, because now you have new words, new labels, new categories to put people in that didn't fit them before.
Yeah.
So you're like, you know, and you know, there is a, as bad as a rap that multicultural days can be, where people are bringing potlucks, bringing in different foods that were, you know, from their countries or from, you know, their parents who might have been the first ones mm-hmm. into the country. You know, having that experience of sharing food starts to expand people.
Oh, yeah. I think those days were dope back in school, the stuff that we did. You know, that was great.
Yeah, but you know, it was absolutely great. And some people would be like, no, I'm not trying that. It looks
That's
weird.
That's true too. You know? I feel like the older we get, the more set in our ways that we get. And, you know, I kind of going back to what I said back in school when still young, impressionable, and still open to certain things like that. Try to do something like that in a workplace, that'd be probably seen differently.
Well, I worked at school, so let me tell you.
Yeah.
As much as kids get a you know, they're promoted as being open and ready for new experiences, they're not all.
Oh, well, yeah. Vegetables, you know, are still yucky.
Yeah. And so there's experiences, you know, with sensory issues. Like, I cannot eat, like, a kid would say, oh, that's creamy. I don't do that. I don't eat that kind of stuff. You know, or I don't eat fish. It's nasty. Or they don't like the texture of eggs. You know, it's like, I was brought up that anything you got put in front of you, find a way to eat it.
And oh my God.
Whether
yeah.
you like it or not, find a way.
That's very different to me. And I'll admit that part is very foreign because, my nickname has been like a human garbage disposal where like you put it in front of me, it's getting eaten. So, but you're right. That is a thing that seems to be popping up more and more when it comes to the sensitivity of the textures of foods. And one thing that I heard that was very interesting, and obviously you being closer in the field than myself, when it comes to like fruits and vegetables versus like, say like a potato chip or a cookie, a kid knows what to expect out of a potato chip or a cookie.
Yes.
A potato chip and a cookie are going to be the same thing over and over and over again.
Yes.
While a vegetable or a fruit, you can get a ripe one, you can get an unripe one, you can get one that's older, younger. Is this mushy? Is it harder? Is it juicier? Is it watery? Is it whatever? You have
you
all the different
so right.
variables to it.
I never thought of that. You're right.
Where a kid, where you're used to a cookie, you get a cookie, but you get a vegetable, you get a stalk of broccoli. That stalk of broccoli could be hard, could be cold, cooked, could be whatever. It's going to be all these different things, and the textures will not be the same from one stalk to another.
And how offended a kid will be if you give them an oatmeal cookie with raisins. And they were expecting to have a chocolate chip. They're like,
yep,
this is chocolate chip.
That's also true, too. Exactly.
But now that you say that, I'm like, wow, you know, like so many times it's like, you know, you get some, you know, a container of strawberries.
Yep.
Some of the strawberries are sweet. There's no strawberry that you expected to have.
Yeah.
And then there's the other strawberries that are bitter
yep.
or sour. And
or bigger like, or smaller. The smaller? Ones have the bigger leaves on them, less leaves on them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Does this have like a little green dot on it? Is that a good dot? Is that a bad dot?
Yes.
What do you have?
There's a lot of, load. There's a cognitive aesthetic load that goes on where you're trying to say, does this fit?
Yeah.
As a good piece of fruit.
Yeah.
You know, I remember like that was another obsession I had one time, especially because when we moved into this area at the culinary.
Yeah.
So for me to imagine that idea of getting the right cut of meat.
Mm.
And it's like, I don't know how to do that. Mm. I'm sure when you go to the culinary, you know how to get the best cut of meat. You know exactly how to cook that meat, how to prepare it. You know, it's like all this awareness about food. You know, what's a good ripe vegetable? Is this vegetable ready for eating? Or is it something we have to pickle? Mm. Or, you know, it's like, it just blows my mind. Ceviche.
Yeah.
You know, my wife is from Ecuador.
Yeah.
So she introduced me to ceviche. And ceviche generally is cooked by the acid of the lime, lemon, the citrus mm-hmm. that you add.
Yeah.
And it's just like, you can cook with fruit.
Yeah.
And it's just, wow, your world just opens up.
Yeah.
Like, what else can, do people do with food?
One of the things that I'm getting out of this episode in particular is just widening your perspective and your awareness and understanding there is more kinds of vocabularies than the one that you currently have.
Oh, yeah.
You know, one of the things, we're here at the MHA studios. I brought this up a couple of times now where, mental health was not in my vocabulary when I was younger, and I look back at some of the times, like say in high school where I was having really bad panic attacks, we thought they were cardiac issues.
Oh, yeah.
I don't blame my parents. I don't blame myself for it. We just didn't think of it. It was just not in our vocabulary at the time.
We didn't have the
literacy. We didn't have that sense of literacy. So, and that can be applied to so many various things, whether that's in education, whether that's in expression, whether that's in culture and cooking, as the last thing that you said there. You know, it's such a big thing of just expanding one's vocabulary. And, they always say is like, if you find that you're the smartest person in the room, leave that room.
Yeah.
Because that's not where you want to be. You want to be challenged. You want to understand. You want to learn. You know, the moment that you think that you know everything is the moment that you are stifled for the rest of your life.
There you go.
So as we wrap up this episode here and as we're talking about this book, how do you believe that this book can help widen people's vocabularies? Or if it doesn't actually widen their vocabulary, how do you think it enables them to make that more accessible to them?
I like that word, enabling.
Yeah.
Because it's a description, like it's basically metaphysics. It's about thinking. It's how we feel. It's about that. How do you, the esoteria is getting the inside information out to people, and you have to have a common language,
mm-hmm.
okay, so that they understand what you're saying. And the tool, you have the framework, but you also have the tool to help. Like, it can't be just one-sided. For students who are struggling with trying to explain why they can't start a certain assignment.
Yeah.
To the teacher who's just assuming they can't do it because they're lazy, you know, and meanwhile, there's a communication issue, but it's the communication of readiness too, where you can learn so many different like emergency techniques. But once that emergency comes, you freeze up. You don't know where to start. You don't know what to do first, you know, so that's when the training, that's when the drilling comes in to develop that readiness and learning a new language. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm trying to learn Spanish. I'm learning Spanish, but you know what? Sometimes I get too anxious in front of a Spanish speaker. I'm suddenly overwhelmed with, you know, my projections onto this person, what they must think of me not being able to pronounce the words or put words together. And, you know, there are different groups now. There's one that meets in New Paltz, one that met last night in New Paltz, where they meet once a week, and it's in a safe environment where they encourage you to try to speak to each other. And you have like a person who's fluent helping guide you, but you're actually getting those words out, and there's a different connection there.
It's so a muscle memory.
It's muscle memory. It's also the cognitive part because your role as a Spanish speaker, you know, your role as someone who connects to others, you know, you are enacting that role. You're not this person that just sits back and watches. Now you're a participant. And, you know, these different roles, things are that we enact, we have to develop. In school, and I'm not answering your question right away, but in school, a new thing that teachers are doing now is telling their students who they are, becoming. So they say, okay, you guys, you're my mathematicians. You're my scientists.
Yeah.
What are the scientists? So the teacher is building those scientist skills, teaching those scientist questioning methods, you know, your inquiry, you know, the way you test your ideas, test your beliefs. And it's a role that's easier to embody, enact, than to just say, we're going to do science.
Yeah. When I worked in summer camps, I was a camp counselor for like 12 years doing science camps, outdoor adventure camps, things along those lines where it was very hands-on. And one of the big things that we learned was like, yeah, give them a role, give them a title. They'll feel more empowered to do something than simply like, hey, it's time to do this.
Yes.
It's like, they'll be like, well, why?
Yeah.
It's they'll question it and they'll challenge it more. And that's not just for kids. That's just for anybody.
It's for anybody.
Anybody.
I mean, one of the things to say about imposter syndrome, you know, it's a role. And a lot of times it's a role that you might not normally fit as a stereotype. You might be a person of color. You might be a woman. And the people around you have to also recognize and promote and encourage that role. Okay.
Yeah.
So it's not just on you. You know, yes, you are doing that role, but what is a teacher? A teacher without students is not a teacher.
Amen.
You are not teaching. You can have the title. If you're doing comedy, you're a comedian and nobody laughs at your jokes, how are you a comedian?
Nah.
You're not funny.
Yeah.
You know, so all these different like social roles where your job is to interact and engage others in particular ways. You need that other person. If you're a leader, you need to have people who are willing to follow you. And that role is socially supported. But to answer your question about this, I see this as like a communication tool. You know, if you're going into therapy and, you know, they're asking you about your day or how about the week, what happened? And you can tell them not just about some of the emotions you experienced, but the situations where you experienced them and the goals that you had that you were trying to accomplish and they were somehow thwarted or interfered with, or, you know, because of your emotions or because of your expectations or because of others. You have a more granular way, a more detailed way to express that experience.
Yeah.
So that then your therapist can say, I get what you're saying, and they can get deeper into what those struggles were and help you problem solve and plan for the next time you're in that situation. And it's the same thing with teachers. The student who's struggling with what and why, I mean, I explained it 10,000 times, why don't you get this? Yeah. And it's like, well, it's because, and then they could say.
Yeah.
And the teachers could also learn from, you know, this idea of role enactment, of telling students who they are becoming so that they can do these things, so that they don't feel like that sense of imposter or that level of imposter syndrome where I'm not a math person. You are a math person because now you're a mathematician and you're learning to become a better mathematician. And that's a different food. I'm trying to lose weight. What do they tell you now? They don't say, stop eating those foods. They say, I'm not the person that eats that kind of food. I'm not a drinker. I don't drink alcohol. I'm an athlete. I'm active. I do athletic things. I do athlete-ish things.
Yeah.
You know, so be having that role, there's less resistance because now it's not you resisting to not do something. You know, like with hypnosis, you use positive commands and positive behavioral interventions. You use positives. These are the things you are trying to accomplish, not avoiding these 3 million other things that you shouldn't do. It's this is what athletes do. This is what French speakers do. Okay. This is what a podcaster does. You know, so all of these things, you learn the role. And you have flexibility to express that role in different ways, but there are some core things you need to do.
Yeah.
And that's, teachers can learn that and be aware of that. And they can start to say, oh, this might be why the student's resisting. I mean, the kid that might be told by their friends to stop being a tryhard, you know, stop being such a tryhard. And you say, well, I'm being a student.
Yeah.
You know, I want to be a good student. I want to be an A student. That's not me being a tryhard. That's me being a good student. That's a different identity. That's a different role I'm playing. So, you know, going towards something and becoming something makes it easier to access certain skills, certain knowledge. And you see that all the time. You know, you're in different groups and your vocabulary gets stunted because they don't know your language. They don't know your experience. But other groups, oh, yeah, you know, you flow with them.
Yeah.
You know, it's so weird. Identity and roles is... That's a whole, I mean, it's the cognitive domain, but such a big area to get into.
It is such a big area. You know, what you said at the very beginning of this and what you just touched upon now about that code shifting and the different languages, what you say to one group versus another group. I remember I was aware of it, but I felt like the first time I was able to like really, truly understand it and materialize it, put a name to it, was when I read To Kill a Mockingbird, when Scout went with her nanny to her church and understood and saw that there was a difference in the way that she talked in her household versus how she talked with her community.
Yes.
And it's like, why do you do that? What's this? And I found it to be a very fascinating chapter, and it was something that I witnessed in life, but it was never something that I ever really put a finger on until like I read it in that moment. It was like, that's interesting. That's fascinating. And does it make one does one version of yourself feel like a lesser version of you, or is it just simply the way that we go about through different scenarios and communicate? Is it really taking away from yourself, or is it just making yourself more accessible to a different variety of people?
Well, you know what? Artists are great when, you know, they are ahead of scientists. You know, isn't that crazy? Like, you know, painters, they do things with color. They observe and recognize and play with color and light. And then the scientists come along and say, wow, you know, that's a good point. What is it about light? And then they start adding their math and their experiments. So, you know, it's the same thing with the code switching. I mean, that I forgot all about that in To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yeah.
So that's a powerful point that's being studied. So let's see. All right, going back to that chart, the communication chart.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking of the expression, what comes to mind is actors. This is my instrument.
Yes.
You know, this is my instrument. This is how I express ideas. This is how I express myself in these different ways. Your whole body, all of these domains, you are accessing different parts, mixing and matching things to communicate different experiences, different worlds, different spaces, interact in different kinds of spaces. And some things you don't say in a church. There are certain things, certain ways you dress in certain churches that are allowed and not allowed in other churches, you know? And it's an interesting question because it comes up a lot where people have to code switch. It comes up a lot where people have to hide who they are in different communities because sometimes it's a distraction from the message. Okay, like sometimes talking about values or the aesthetics can get mixed up when people are really worried about who are you married to. You know, and it's like, that has nothing to do with it. You know, you have that halo effect. You have, you know, that whole idea, like, you know, there's certain people that no matter what they do, it looks right. You know, you have like, a joke kind of thing, you know, the 50 Shades of Grey. Okay. And it was a funny little meme. He said, you know, this billionaire doing this 50 Shades of Grey stuff, that's hot. But this guy in the trailer park trying to do that, maybe he's a serial killer, you know, and they could have the same reasons for doing the motivations for doing this. But, because of the socioeconomic reception, you're not so ready to accept certain things.
Yeah.
You know, it's so funny how the, so sometimes you can, that role you're trying to fit into to communicate a certain idea can limit you because it's not showing your whole self, but you don't, as much as people try to say, you bring your whole self to work, bring your whole self. No, they don't want you to show your whole self at work. And that's
and not I wouldn't want to personally either.
It's like, that's distraction. We have a job to do. Maybe, you know, a little glimpse of it to, you know, to communicate with a prospective client or, you know, just to say like, I'm like you, or you can trust me, or I'm going to work with you, that kind of idea.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you can show a little bit more, but you're always deciding how you're going to present yourself and why. And what you should say and what you shouldn't say. You're limiting yourself. And yeah, sometimes that's restrictive and other times necessarily so, you know, because your message is your goal to try to communicate, not to distract from it.
Yeah. No, I think those are all very, very good points. Dwayne, this has been a phenomenal episode and I really appreciate all your time, all of your perspective. And hopefully that helps widen somebody else's perspective out there. So, of course, a week from when this is airing will be the Willow Bookshop Lounge signing. What do you have to say to the people who are coming out to the signing, or they're just seeing this and they're considering coming out to the signing? What do you got to say to the Walsh Wednesday listening audience out there?
Well, there's going to be an activity. I'm not just going to talk. I'm going to expose you to the process, you know, of metacognition, reflecting, and reporting, but a light version so everybody can get it. And the other thing is I'm open to doing workshops to different organizations, to schools, to workplaces. You know, it's so many different ways to apply these ideas and to explain why something's working. So I'm hoping to get the word out there. I'm hoping to get that communication flowing so that more is shared and understood. And hopefully, like you said, expanding people's perspectives, expanding their awareness of systems. And making distinctions between things is just, I'm an educator. That's kind of like my why. Yeah. You know, that's what I'm passionate about.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Mm-hmm. Experience that why at the Willow Bookshop on Wednesday, July 15th. We'll have more information in the description of this episode. Dwayne, again, appreciate you being here.
Thank you for having me. This is so exciting. I just loved it.
I'm Connor.
And I'm Dwayne.
And as always, we're glad we get to.
Got the line.
You're good. Happens more often than you think. I'm Connor.
And I'm Dwayne.
And as always, we're glad we get to
spend some time.
And that's a wrap on this week's episode. Much love to our sponsors this week, MHA of Dutchess County, Foman Wash Car Wash, Juniors 2, the Kyle Robinson Memorial Foundation, Council on Addiction Prevention and Education of Dutchess County Incorporated, Dayrock, Feldman, Kleiman, Collins & Sape, LLP, Attorneys at Law, and Walsh Valuation. Last but not least, thank you to our Walsh Wednesday All-Stars, those who have generously contributed to the 2026 Walsh Wednesday Fund Drive. It's through your support that Walsh Wednesday can continue to bring quality programming. If you'd like to donate or learn more about becoming a sponsor, please email connor@cmjwentertainment.com. Thank you once again, and for Walsh Wednesday, I'm Connor, and I'm glad we get to spend some time.